Hello and welcome to the Nourish, Balance, Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined by Megan Roberts. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank you very much for asking. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to be on this show, especially since this is one of my absolute favorite podcasts. I have to make a confession that I'll probably be a little bit sad when this one airs because I won't have one to listen to that week.
No, I tell you what, I listen to all of my podcasts at least twice more because...
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
wow. Quite often when I'm talking to the person live, the information doesn't sink in. And it's only when I go through and create the show notes. If you go to the show notes for my podcast, you can get to those by going to nourishbalancethrive.com/podcast. You'll see that I have two podcasts. You click on the link. You drill down to an individual episode and I create these timelines with what was said at what exact time. And then quite often I give the references there. So when I'm making those show notes, that's when it all sort of sinks in and I check on references. And I also like to listen to see where I sound like a dork and think of ways in which I could try and improve. So that's
yeah,
gonna be
I'm
extra weird.
I'm listening to myself.
No, you'll be great. I'm absolutely sure. So I know Megan quite well now. We've been working together for a little while. I first met Megan at a Paleo Health Symposium in San Francisco. That was just over a year ago because that symposium just took place again. And unfortunately, I was in Colorado. Megan was too. So we were unable to attend, but that was great. And I know that some of those videos are now available online. So I will link to it, especially Rob Wolf's was absolutely fantastic. Stefan Guionade, Justin Sonnenberg. Do you remember that on the gut microbiome was a really, really good one. Those are really beautiful images. So I should link to those in the show notes. And I got up and asked a question and I can't remember what my stupid question was. I think it was something like, hey, I went to Sutter Health and I saw one of the doctors there and they didn't say anything about paleo. What's up with that? And Megan heard me ask that question in the audience. And I guess, did you recognize my voice from the podcast?
I did, yeah.
And so we met that way and we became friends through email. And Megan has recently been writing some really nice articles for me, which have been appearing on my website. And I'll link to those as we talk about them today in this interview. But why don't we get started by me asking you about what developed your interest in health? Like, why do you care about the inner workings of the human body?
So I've kind of always been a lifetime, I guess, fitness and nutrition enthusiast. Admittedly, I also have kind of a black and white extremist type A personality that can get me in trouble.
I recognize that.
Yes. So I went to UC Davis and I got my bachelor's degree in exercise biology and then my master's degree in nutritional biology in hopes of my master's kind of being a useful adjunct to a future medicine career. Mm-hmm. I'll be applying to medical school soon. And throughout this whole time, like college and high school, I kind of had this quest to optimize my health, but paradoxically, it ultimately kind of made me less and less healthy over the years as I tried to optimize it. And so I spent a lot of my high school and college years underfueling all of my overtraining. And I just wrote an article, which will probably soon be published on the website about that. So stay tuned. And so all of this underfueling, overexercise on top of a high-strung personality kind of snowballed myself into kind of a major stress response. And eventually all these symptoms of too much stress, all in the name of good health, but still too much stress started manifesting. And so symptoms such as like underactive thyroid, fatigue, major gut problems, and also some low-grade anxiety and depression from time to time.
Hmm.
So,
what type of training were you doing?
I hate to admit this, but I was getting up early, 5:30 a.m., doing fasted workouts, pretty high intensity, kind of CrossFit style, some weightlifting, and it wasn't conducive to my lifestyle at the time. And I think, you know, intense fasted training sessions probably have their place, but not 7 days a week, that's for sure.
What was your goal? What did you think it would do for you?
Well, I was doing it at that time of day because that's when I had the time
right
to do it. Whereas I quickly learned that it was far better for me to sleep in and get rest rather than train intensely. But as far as my goals, it was all in the name of health. You know, you read all of these health experts online talking about intermittent fasting and high intensity interval training and ketogenic diets and low carb diets and all of these things. And I drank the Kool-Aid to say the least. But,
yeah, the problems can come when you misunderstand the context in which some expert is operating in. And then sometimes absolutely. You can get into trouble when you try and overlay all these things. You know, Tommy's talked about this a lot in public recently, that you hear, you know, Ron Rosedale talking about protein restriction and then Dominic D'Agostino talking about the ketogenic diet. I guess they're both on the same kind of vector, aren't they? But, and mm-hmm. then intermittent fasting, and then maybe extended fasting and fasted state training. And then before you know it, you're doing all of these things, which is great. Good for you. You know, you can get shit done, but yeah. Maybe it doesn't get you the, get you what you want. So I just wonder, so what did you think? You were just looking to build muscle or lose weight or?
No, not lose weight. Actually, I was kind of looking to gain some weight and put on some muscle mass, which in hindsight, what I was doing was absolutely counterproductive. But ultimately, it came down to the fact that I was so worn out, and I don't have any cortisol tests to give you, you know, what my cortisol rhythm looked like. But I think that I was exercising because it was the only thing that made me feel good in the moment.
Right.
And so I was chasing that exercise high only to crash, you know, 2 hours afterward.
I totally understand this. And so I think the same thing happens with caffeine. You know, people mm-hmm. who line up at 7 a.m. in Starbucks, they're not there to get a high. They're there to get back to a baseline. And I think that some athletes are doing that same thing with exercise, right? It's like once I'm warmed up, and I'm going, maybe that takes me an hour if you're on a bike, then that's when I start to feel good. And you don't really feel good. You just feel normal.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you think it was just the exercise then? Did you have a lot going on with your academic work at that time?
I did. And that was the other thing. I was taking a lot of like pre-med classes, and the competition at UC Davis is kind of cutthroat in that area. So I had that. And then when I was doing my master's degree, I had the stress of research on top of that.
Mm.
So yeah, you know, we talk about the whole the idea of allostatic load and the stress bucket.
Right.
And there was just, you know, mine was overflowing.
It's super hard to see it. You almost need someone else to point it out to you. You know, it's...
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you've got the problem I could talk about every week on the podcast, but it's so important. Even if you were to get rid of... If that allostatic load bucket was completely empty, you would just invent something to get stressed out over. So you can't win. You can only change your perception.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. And as far as like food, I've always eaten relatively well as far as whole foods are concerned. But then of course I discovered paleo and had to jump on that bandwagon and quickly realized that for me, it was not a panacea. Paleoing harder and exercising more, they didn't solve my problems. They just made things worse. Probably just added more stress. So they
really?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that taking certain foods out of my diet that I was sensitive to, especially dairy and gluten, that was huge. But when it came to like hyper focusing on what was paleo and what wasn't paleo, that was just
That's very interesting for me to connect the dots here, because that's exactly what Tony Federico said, right? Was mm-hmm. I asked him what wasn't helpful, and he said, oh, pointing out that's not paleo. And I remember reminded Tommy's Icelandic Health Symposium talk, he cited a study that showed that milling over food restrictions raises cortisol, which may be counterproductive, and maybe
absolutely.
That's relevant for you here.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I also kind of had some gut issues, which you and I worked through.
Mm.
And there was clearly a link between the stress that I was experiencing, my underactive thyroid, my poor gut health, and then my kind of weak immune system, which I paradoxically thought my immune system was great because I never got sick. But actually, when you looked on a white blood cell count, my white blood cells were super low. So that kind of suggested otherwise.
Yeah, this is something I would really love to do an in-depth podcast on, because it's mm-hmm. it's really, really interesting. People say this all the time. Oh, I never get sick. I must have a healthy immune system.
Not true.
It's not true. Yeah,
not
and it happened to me at the beginning of this year that I got sick 3 times in a row. And it was like a proper high fever in bed, sweating. And I have not experienced that in years and years and years. And then it just broke just like that. And then I was like, whoa, I'm okay. What just happened? It was really strange. And I've not experienced that in such a long time. And I talked to Tommy about it. And he's like, well, the reason you feel terrible is because of the collateral damage from your immune system doing what it needs to do. And if you never get sick, like, what's your immune system? Are you just really lucky that you never encounter any pathogens in your environment? It's like, it's questionable at best.
Yeah. And like, speaking of pathogens, I think that there's like, my hypothesis for basically what happened was kind of the state of low energy availability from over exercising or over training and under fueling that training suppressed my immune system. And then that also decreased my thyroid function. And then with decreased metabolic fire on top of life stress, basically that was a breeding ground for pathogens and bad gut health.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think it was Robert Sapolsky that I first heard talk about this, that when you think about it, immunity is actually a long-term building project, right? So it's not going to kill you in the next 10 minutes. Maybe you're going to deal with a cancer cell that might kill you in 10 years' time. So it's actually not an immediate concern. It's a long-term building project. And if you're being chased by a tiger, then who cares about long-term building projects? Let's just get the hell out of here, right? I mean, it's that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, absolutely. So ultimately, with the poor gut health, it's interesting because I think that a lot of times people test, you know, do stool tests or whatnot to look for infections or pathogens, and that's kind of their root cause of the problem.
Right.
But for me, like, the poor gut health was both a symptom and a cause.
Right, right.
And so really, I had to dig further and get to the root cause of the poor gut health, which was basically my lifestyle factors.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. That's really amazing insight for you to have. I think it took me a really, really long time to figure that out. But again, that just makes sense. I mean, if you leave a piece of wet bread on the counter in the kitchen, eventually yeast will grow on it and mold will grow on it. And it's not like you really had to do. I mean, the organism is thriving in the environment that's being created for it. So maybe you have to do some remediation on the mold and the yeast, but really the solution is you need to do away with the environment that was conducive to the microbe in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah. And I know that, like, you know, I had to address the lifestyle factors. Otherwise, I'm pretty sure that I'd fix one infection or one problem and then only down the road to have to fix another because I wasn't digging down to the root of the problem that, you know, we talk about so much in functional medicine.
Right. And so how did you do it? I'm really curious to know how you did it because...
Well, first of all, I had to realize the biggest thing was to realize that the same obsessive thinking that got me into the situation wasn't going to get me out. And change is really hard for me. I'm very, very routine oriented.
Right.
But my mom always tells me, and this is always in the back of my mind, but nothing changes if nothing changes. And so I kind of was able to turn some of my obsessive routine oriented habits into new routines that were healthier and more conducive to a better lifestyle. Uh-huh. And so, you know, there's a plethora of things that basically all the things that we always talk about. One of the things was I realized as far as my calories were concerned, I was focusing so much on nutrient density. That's really important, but I kind of forgot about the importance of calorie density at the same time. And for me, eating a really nutrient dense, high fat, low carb diet, it was difficult to get in enough calories.
Right.
And so I had to basically get over my fear of carbs and add more in. And it honestly did wonders for my gym performance, for my energy, for my sleep, for my gut health, because I was having some problems digesting fats. So that was definitely a big...
How did you develop a fear of carbohydrates? Because I know that the research that you've been doing at UC Davis is in the ketogenic diet.
Yeah.
And so you have a tremendous amount of technical insight there. But is that what led to your fear of carbohydrates, or was it something completely different?
That was honestly a lot of it. Because when you're immersed in this like low carb ketogenic diet literature, I mean, maybe it's just my personality, but I got kind of carb phobic. And also, you know, listening to some of the low carb enthusiasts out there, I don't need to name names, I'm sure they're obvious, but it's always restricting carbohydrates in the name of health. And like I said in the beginning, all of this was kind of my goal was to optimize my health. And so I thought that restricting carbohydrates would do that.
Okay.
But for somebody who's active and young and very insulin sensitive, like I didn't need to do that.
Right. Who are you and what are your goals?
Exactly. Yeah. And so I also a big thing was learning to listen and tune into my own physiology rather than taking the advice of the masses. So the carbohydrates are one example of that, but also, it's kind of funny, but being an exercise biology major, I was absolutely convinced that I needed like a whey protein shake every time after I finished a workout. But given the context, you know, an intense workout, probably some post-workout gut permeability, and then the potential gut irritants and the whey protein, a shake was probably doing me more harm than good. And I would always feel awful after drinking it, but I told myself that it was the right thing to do. So I really had to tune in to what my body was telling me.
Yes. Oh my God. It's amazing. Like, you've got such a different background, but some of the lessons learned are very similar. And of course, my interview with Ellen Langer, did you listen to that one where she...
Oh, yeah.
It's just so important. I mean, for me, it was oatmeal. You know, I'd feel catastrophically awful after eating this wretched bowl of oatmeal. I'd be bloated, brain fog, tired, and I would still do it anyway. Like, what are you doing? Like, why don't you think about what it is that's making you feel so awful? But for some reason, you don't.
For sure. Mm-hmm. And then I also mentioned this before, but it helped me change my routine when I moved from California out to Colorado, because I was able to cut the intense 6 a.m. workouts. And I began to sleep in. And yes, I do still get harassed by my friends and family for wearing those dorky blue blocking glasses at night. But it's totally worth it. It really is totally worth it.
Excellent. So what was it? You know, you asked Tommy a really interesting question at Low Carb Breckenridge, and I don't feel like I had a very good answer because it doesn't come up very much. And your question was, what food should I eat to gain weight? So tell us about why you asked that and what Tommy's answer was and what you ended up doing.
Right. So Tommy, maybe you can link to it in the show notes, but he did an amazing presentation on sometimes when high fat diets may not be working for you. So if your gut health isn't top notch, then you can get increased basically endotoxin with higher fat intakes in your diet. And so that kind of sparked my interest because I was trying to gain weight and put on muscle with a really high fat diet. And I was feeling really awful, and probably because of some poor gut health. So I was interested in what the optimal kind of macronutrient ratio would be for somebody looking to minimize metabolic damage while putting on some healthy weight and muscle. And he told me that basically he said, eat like a sumo wrestler. So
you should explain. So I think you can explain quite well that sumo wrestlers are very, very interesting, right? On the surface, they look obese, but metabolically, they're perfectly healthy. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, they're very insulin sensitive. So he told me, you know, just eat a bunch of carbs and very little fat. And that, you know, that would be the best way to do that. And again, it's extreme. And something that I was going to bring up later, but I'll just bring it up now, is, and this is definitely not an original idea. Actually, I think that Chris Masterjohn mentioned this on the Keto Summit, but just the idea that the diet and lifestyle that is best for you now probably won't be the diet and lifestyle that's best for you in five years' time.
That's very frustrating, isn't it? You know, everybody has that. They look back and think, oh, for me, it's like 2014 or maybe 2013 was the year that I got my USAC pro license and I was winning every Masters Category 1 race that I entered. And sometimes think, oh, I just need to think, what was I doing right then, right? Like, if I could just recreate that, then surely I would get the same results. And no, it doesn't work like that, unfortunately. You just got to keep figuring it out all of the time.
Yeah, and it's really important, I think, to tune in and be mindful of what you need, because at least for me, it's been really hard to live in this world where everybody is completely obsessed with losing weight. They take pride in getting 5 hours of sleep rather than 8 hours of sleep, and they multitask, and they intermittent fast, and they take exercise to the extreme. When for my health, really, I had to do the exact opposite.
Right, right. That must be quite isolating, actually, when I think about it. You know, I've just been making the show notes for Tommy's interview with Mike Mutzel. So that'll be out by the time that this one comes out. I'll link to that in the show notes. But Mike mentioned it, that when you've discovered this new diet and lifestyle and nobody else you know even understands one bit of it, that can be quite isolating. And I wonder whether you might find the same when, you know, you're the super skinny girl that's looking to put on some more muscle, when everybody around you is like looking at you thinking, God, if only I could be like you. It's like quite isolating, don't you think? Or maybe not.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I was actually going to talk about social isolation next. So that's a good...
Good segue.
So yeah, there's that whole idea about kind of having to go against the grain. And then also the fact that when I was so hyper-focused a couple years back on physically healing myself, I kind of let my social connections slide.
Right.
I would go to sleep early, and not that I should be staying up late, but you know, I would let some social things fall by the wayside so that I could get up early and do my workout and, you know, XYZ. Whereas since then, I've definitely realized the importance of community and friendship, and kind of getting out of my own head and doing random acts of kindness for other people has really been kind of a game changer. And even like something that I try to do I was thinking about this while I was walking in the park this morning, but just making eye contact with somebody when you pass them and smiling rather than looking down at the ground.
Yeah.
It's so foreign in this world. And so some people might not look back at you, but when they do, they have this like look of surprise on their face, and it's good surprise.
Yeah.
But that's just so foreign in today's society. And also,
I don't think that about Americans at all. When you come from the UK, I mean, I think some British people will probably be hating me for saying this right now, but the Americans are very, I think, very friendly. You go to, you go to like a supermarket or something, the person on the checkout is just unreasonably friendly, in my opinion. And
that is true.
If you want to see surly and unfriendly, then I'd recommend the London Underground. Like, I'll give you £1 for each person you can make eye contact with on the London Underground, in, you know, on any one train ride, be it in the morning or night. It's, I guess maybe that's just a city thing. You know, people start to get a bit worried about who it is they're going to run into at any one time, and so they don't make eye contact. Perhaps that's some of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another thing that, as far as things that I changed in my lifestyle, was cultivating kind of some kind of meditation or mindfulness practice. And Headspace has been a game changer. And I really do have to prioritize it. And I have to do it first thing in the morning. Yeah. Otherwise, it won't happen.
Interesting.
And especially have to prioritize it when I tell myself that I don't have the time, because that's when I probably need it the most.
Right, right. That's a really good observation. Very difficult and very good observation.
Yeah. And I think sometimes in general, just the things that we resist the most might just be the things that we need the most. And for me, that was meditation. I couldn't sit long enough, you know, to do a sitting meditation, and I couldn't walk without having podcasts and going in my ears.
Right.
And, you know, it's been a struggle, but it's been, you know, when I don't do it, I definitely feel it. So,
yeah, I think that is actually the genius of Headspace, is that it's not really meditation, even though that's what it's branded. It's therapy. Andy Puddicombe is giving you therapy without actually being there present to talk to you in person. And I think that's why a lot of people, they're fearful of meditation, is because they're worried about what thoughts they're going to have to face when the busyness goes away, right? They're constantly busy all day long. Oh, crap, I'm really going to have to think about this thing that's been deeply concerning me for a long time. And Andy Puddicombe, through Headspace, he walks you through all that. And like, he counsels you. So that's what makes it successful. Eventually, when you get into the later episodes, it's just you sitting silently. And then it's not so hard because he's coached you up to that point where you're able to do that. I think it's very clever.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would definitely recommend it. It's a great starting place. And it's, you know, you can even just listen to the first 10 over and over and over.
Sometimes. I've noticed that the app, it keeps forcing me to continue on wherever I left off. And I'm like, you know what? I kind of just want to do the 10-minute ones at the start again. And this morning with my daughter, I did. So I don't know if people know this, but there's a Headspace Kids now inside of the app. And my daughter's 3.5 and we were in the sauna this morning. And she did 4 minutes. She did, there's a little 1 minute introduction, and then there's a 3 minute episode. And she did both of them. And I was absolutely amazed, but she loved it. It's like just enough distraction, you know, wiggle your toes, wiggle your knees, and then stop. And then he walks you all through it. It's like, and she really enjoyed it. And she was really proud of herself for having sat through a baby meditation. So maybe people listening can check that out with their kids.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I think starting kids out with some mindfulness and meditation at that age is a really good kind of good grounding for them to have later in life. It'll probably be easier for them down the road. And then just kind of in general, one other thing I wanted to say was, with all of this, both my personal kind of journey and then also my research in nutrition and getting my master's degree helped with this, but just becoming less extreme and less black and white in my thinking.
Right.
It was really important for my critical thinking skills, one, and also my health too.
Yeah, I mean, this is why we love Brian Walsh so much, is he's teaching critical thinking as well as just the biochemistry, right? And that critical thinking part is just so important. For me, it was just everything I heard on the podcast was good advice in the beginning. You know, I'd listen to the Ben Greenfield podcast and just do everything he said, and everything got good results. I was like, well, in that case, everything I hear on all of the podcasts must be good advice. So I'm going to do everything. And then eventually you come unstuck in ways that you've just described with this black and white thinking. And then, oh no, now I'm going to do, like, you really have to start using your brain at that point.
Right, for sure.
Has it been working then? So you ate some more carbs, you went for a lower fat approach, and you're still lifting, but maybe not quite the crazy schedule.
Yeah. So I wouldn't even say that. I mean, some people might think that this is bad kind of nutritional advice, and I'm not advising anyone to do it. But for me, like, my diet's still pretty high in fat, and it's relatively high in carbs. I'm getting, you know, 150, 200 grams a day, but I kind of strategically time my carbohydrates. And when I'm having a higher carbohydrate meal, I kind of lower the fat, but still I need the fat to get the calories in.
Right, right, right. So when you say strategically time, how do you time them?
So typically the majority of them will be after a workout.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's still those CrossFit style workouts that you're doing?
No, no, that's the other thing. I suddenly have let those go. And now it's purely strength training in the gym and then walking as much as I can outside.
Okay. And do you miss that? You know, so one of the things that I think is really nice about CrossFit, even, and I think this even though I've never done it, but I it really appeals to me, the idea of the community. And I've got a friend over here. We're going to go ride our bikes in a bit. And we just did a strength training session here in the garden. And it was great to like do it with someone rather than just do it by myself. And so do you miss that about CrossFit?
Well, I actually wasn't even at a CrossFit box or anything. I was okay. just making it kind of my own very
Oh
CrossFit
my goodness, you were taking workout. The worst and the worst.
Yeah, exactly. So honestly, like when I made, you know, when I mentally made the decision to quit those type of workouts, it was like a relief.
Oh, really? It's like somebody yeah. lifted the weight off your shoulders.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, when I feel like doing something more intense, I will. But yeah, for now, strength training and hiking out here in the mountains and walking is really the best thing for me.
That's amazing. Yeah, Colorado lifestyle, very conducive to good health, I think. How have you been adapting to the altitude? That was sleeping in Breckenridge. I had like mild sleep apnea. It was pretty crazy. I was waking up in the middle of the night gasping for breath. How have you been able to adapt to that? It's pretty tough.
The first like maybe week or so that I moved out here, I could definitely tell that it was going to, you know, I was having a little bit harder time breathing. I had, you know, if we went on hikes, I couldn't go as fast as I normally would. But after that, after you've been up here a week, maybe 5 days, I think you adapt pretty fast.
Yeah, you do. You do to a certain extent. I think I stopped feeling like crap after about a week, but I still notice, you know, if you're hiking a ridgetop at 10,000 plus feet, like I know my heart, wasn't wearing a heart rate monitor, but you know, hiking with a snowboard, I could feel that my heart rate was like 170 or something. And I was barely moving, you know, like just putting one boot in front of the other. It's absolutely crazy. And it must be, so you can adapt a bit, but you're never going to go as fast as you do at sea level, surely.
No, absolutely. I mean, just to kind of wrap up the whole lifestyle stuff real fast. I kind of like, in hindsight, I realized that if I weren't so dang stubborn and that it probably wouldn't have taken me so long to get to where I am.
Right.
Like physically and mentally and having just this better headspace. But I can't say that I didn't learn anything along the way. And I think that kind of my journey and what I've been through, I hope it can be of use to others.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say, there's no way that you could write these articles for me as well as you do had you not been through this personally, I think, even though you have such tremendous knowledge from your academic career.
Yeah. There's no, you know, experience is really the best teacher, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about your research? I just had a couple of questions that I thought you might be able to answer. The first one is the $64,000 question. Will all the ketogenic diet help me live longer?
depends on if you're mouse or human.
Okay. So we don't know the question, the answer to that in humans, certainly. But
yeah.
Do you have an opinion? You know, I know you do a lot of reading. Do you have an opinion at this stage?
So the thing about rodent studies is that you keep everything so neat and tidy and only manipulate one variable. Right. So these rodents are in these cages and the only thing, you know, you're manipulating is their food intake or their light exposure or something. Whereas for people, there's so many different life variables that happen. I don't think just saying that eating a ketogenic diet will increase your lifespan. I think that there's so many other inputs into the equation of health.
Right,
I think that it definitely has therapeutic potential. And I think that kind of cycling in and out of ketosis can be potentially a metabolically very healthy thing to do. As far as lifespan's concerned, I just don't think so.
Yeah, that's a really good answer. Yeah, of course, even if someone were to show in a human that it extends lifespan, then you would still not be able to translate that to yourself directly. It's all based in probabilities.
Right. Again, it's the context question, you know.
And do you think there's going to be gender differences? So obviously things didn't turn out super well for you, but again, it would be unfair to say it's just the ketogenic diet that was the cause of your problems. There was a lot of stuff going on, but again, with the research that you've done, are you expecting to see gender differences?
I would like to say yes. But again, for rodents, I know there are gender differences as far as how lifespan is affected with different interventions, including dietary interventions. But as far as humans go, again, I think that some women can thrive on a ketogenic diet if everything else is in place. And it can maybe even be therapeutic for some women if they're having specific hormonal issues. But for others, you know, it might not work out so well. And again, it's kind of that you kind of ebb and flow with life.
Well, let's talk about the first article that you wrote for us, which is the Ironman Guide to Ketosis. And I think you've developed a really great working relationship with Tommy, where you're synthesizing a lot of stuff and then he does a round of editing and then it goes around in circles for a little bit. And it's really fun to watch. Are you enjoying that? First of all, do you think it's working? And, you know, is this how it works in academia?
Well, first of all, yes, I'm absolutely loving it. I'm having a blast. I just wish there were more hours in a day so I could get on more articles. But as far as how it works in academia, for me, when I was writing my master's thesis, actually, it was very similar. You know, I would get all my thoughts out and then my supervisor or some of my other mentors would read over it and comment. And if they, you know, obviously Tommy is very well versed in the literature and I try to be as much as possible, but I've had less experience. And so it's always nice to have that kind of outside person who is very well versed and knows the literature.
He is kind of saying,
hey, here's another study you might not have heard
about.
Yeah,
so exactly. So Tommy, he is the PubMed pro. I mean, pro is the operative word, right? He does this for a living. And not only has he seen a lot of stuff, like he, you know, can remember studies that he's seen in the past that gives you the answer to the question that you're asking. But also, if he has a question and he hasn't seen a study before, he'll find all the research that's been done on it in less than 10 minutes. It's absolutely amazing. You know, like I'll sit there and try and answer a question using PubMed. And 2 hours later, I feel like I've absolutely no closer to answering my question, where he is hugely efficient. And I guess that's just a function of the work that he's been doing over the last 15 years.
Yeah, it can definitely get to be a rabbit hole if you don't know where to look.
Yeah, this first article, The Ironman Guide to Ketosis, I'll link to it in the show notes. And I think this is a really nice beginner's guide. You know, I was really hoping that some people that were unfamiliar with what the word meant and what the diet could potentially offer them as an endurance athlete would read this article and have a really nice, well-rounded, evidence-driven introduction to the topic. And there's certainly some benefits. I'm not sure that I would prescribe this for every Ironman athlete, but I think it should be a tool in their box, right, that they should know about. And we did get into a little bit of trouble, didn't we? We wanted to find a case study of someone that had done, you know, long term really well doing triathlons, eating this diet. And we kind of struggled a little bit, didn't we? In the end, we went with Ben Greenfield and we had quite a lot of pushback in the comments, you know, people saying, oh, actually, Ben Greenfield destroyed his thyroid function with this diet. Why are you citing him as a success story? Do you think that's fair? And what do you think we should do about that in the future? Maybe not have said anything in the first place.
Yeah. And I know Ben has been very open about what he could have done differently and what he does differently now as far as fueling his training and his racing. I know he still prescribes to a high fat diet, but not strict ketosis all the time. So I think it's very individual. But there's people like Mark Gazzella and Zach Bitter,
right,
Tim Olson, and a lot of these people are they have been very successful high fat, if not ketogenic diets.
Right. We should have not been so strict with ourselves and insisting that it be an Ironman triathlete and maybe gone with someone who's doing similar ultra distance events, but maybe not Ironman, because it doesn't matter that much, right? So yeah, Mark Cucuzella is a really great example. The other thing that came out of that article, which is, I think, an important point, is that, you know, most people consider to be less than 50 grams of carbohydrates per day to be ketogenic, but that may not necessarily be true for somebody who's training for an Ironman triathlon, right? And we've seen examples, certainly in other sports, where people are consuming up to 200 grams per day of carbohydrate, which nobody, you know, like that's never going to be considered a ketogenic diet anywhere in the literature, but they're still achieving high levels of blood ketones. And that's just because they're doing so much goddamn activity, right?
Yeah. And I think that those carbohydrates, you know, we know from the literature that carbohydrates are ergogenic, like they do increase performance. And so I think for both health and performance, even if you're a fat adapted athlete, they definitely have a place.
Yeah, this is a really nice, I'm really, really pleased and proud of you for this article. It's a really nice how-to guide and you talk about slowing down and the Maffetone approach and strength training. And there's some really helpful pointers on how to know it's working. And you talk about testing You talk about the right time to start a ketogenic diet, right? We talked about the allostatic load, like maybe now's, maybe it would work for you in the future at some point, but now's not the right time. That's really, really good information. And then a whole troubleshooting section. So yeah, you've done a fantastic job on that. And I'm really pleased with it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So the next article you wrote was another, it was so cool. You just finished writing this article and it was the answers to real questions that Bob McRae asked, and Bob has been on my podcast quite recently before. Bob's the number one ranked in his age group, USAT triathlete. And he asked some very specific questions about fueling for an Ironman triathlon. And you and Tommy sat down and answered those. And then not long after it was published, somebody asked the exact same questions again. And it's just so cool, isn't it? When you're like, yeah, this is right on the money. Like, this article is exactly the information that people want right now.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, of course, I'll link to that as well. It's the article is called How to Use MCT Oil to Fuel an Ironman Triathlon and How Endurance Training Affects Carbohydrate Intolerance. It's interesting, the approach that, you know, maybe when you're doing such a long event that you would want to take advantage of every available channel in order to get calories on board. And so, you know, most people know that the macronutrients, right, fat, carbohydrate and protein. And typically, I mean, certainly this is, I'm sure what you've seen as an exercise physiologist in the literature, that you really want to stay away from fat during exercise, right? That's not going to work. And anecdotally, that is what people notice, especially with the MCT oil, that it can cause a lot of gastric distress if you're not careful. And that was the problem that we set out to solve with fat fiber. And so far, it seems to be working out great for that. Like, it's not causing anybody any digestive distress. Is there anything you wanted to add? I think you've done, again, a really nice question of answering these specific questions on how I fuel a really long, slow, steady state event.
I don't think so. No, I think, you know, I'm enjoying the questions that come in. So if people have questions, I don't know how you feel about it, but I don't know how they send them in.
Yeah, no,
you know, if they have specific questions, if they want to leave them in the comments.
It's
always good to get some ideas for articles.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, maybe I should encourage people to do that at this time. Like, if you've got some ideas for articles that Megan and Tommy should write, then just ask your questions. Like, what's your number one concern right now? What are you most worried about? And then we can come up with our best. It's not just evidence driven, right? So obviously, we said that Tommy's the PubMed pro and he's really good at pulling out answers from the literature, but also, you know, we're now three, coming up on 4 years old, and we've worked with 1,000 athletes. So we've seen a lot of stuff work and not work in practice as well. So hopefully we'll be able to answer your questions. Talk about the lifestyle article that you've been working on. That's such a, like, to say the lifestyle article. I think that undersells it. It's not a very good title. It's not very clickbaity, isn't it? The real title of the article is Why Your Ketogenic Diet Isn't Working, Part One, Underfueling and Undertraining. I'm sure, like, given the conversation that we've just had, this was a fairly easy article for you to write. It certainly reads beautifully now. What would you say?
Oh, yeah. So this was an article. I was kind of hoping that we would start with this one for the lifestyle series, because it was super easy to write just because of everything that I talked about before. So basically, what I wanted to do was kind of do a lifestyle series about specific reasons why you may be eating a ketogenic diet in ketosis, but it's still not working for either your training, your racing, your overall health. And so we started with this idea that the diet might not be working because you're overtraining and underfueling for that training, which really is a big deal with hard charging endurance athletes, or just athletes in general. And then hopefully in the future, you know, we'll get to other things like sleep and circadian rhythm and social connection and movement and things like that.
Yeah, these are the most important things. I'm really quite sure of it after, like I say, 3 years, 1,000 athletes, which are the things which move the needle the most. And for me personally too, it's been the same, you know, like, You do deep investigations into the immune function. You mentioned their white blood cell count. You can drill down and look at the different types of white blood cell. It leads absolutely nowhere. Like, what are you going to do with that at the end of the day, right? And we hear about so many things on podcasts, you know, heavy metal toxicity and Lyme and its co-infections and Epstein-Barr virus and cytomegalovirus and all this sexy stuff. You know, infectious disease for some reason comes across as super sexy when you talk about it on a podcast. But the truth is that loneliness, photo periods, good quality food, sleep, these super unsexy things. Blood glucose stability, that's another good one, right, that nobody wants to talk about anymore. Like, do you keep really good glycemic control over the course of a day is another one. Super unsexy, but these basic things are the things that are really moving the needle for athletes. Each person's individual, but these are the things that are making the difference for people. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to you drilling down in depth into some of these things.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it as well. It's been a blast so far. So,
Is there a place where people can find you? Have you got home? Are you a Twitter person or Facebook? Or
I have to admit that I'm kind of social media illiterate. I do have a Facebook that I check about once a quarter. but I guess the best place that people could find me would be the articles that I'm helping to write on the Nourish Balance Thrive blog.
And that's very generous of you. Well, yeah, okay. Come to the show notes for this episode. You'll find the articles linked, and then both the show notes and all the articles have a comment section. So if you have a comment or question, then please do ask it and we'll do our very best to get that answered. Well, Megan, this has been an absolute pleasure. I'm delighted to be working with you, and I'm really hoping that you're going to think twice about going to medical school, although I may not have supposed to say that out loud right now.
It's okay. I think I already did, but I'm really enjoying working with you as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Megan.
Thank you.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.